So that we're continuing our panel discussions, and our next panel is focusing on discontinuing or implementing additional standards for the use of the deferred sales charge purchase option, the DSC option. And our panelists for this discussion are John Adams, CEO of PFSL Investments Canada, affiliated with Primerica, Sunny Goldstein, President at Goldstein Financial, Barry McInerney, President and CEO of McKenzie Financial, and Marion Passmore, Director of Policy and Chief Operating Officer, Canadian Foundation for Advancement of Investor Rights, or FAIR. So first I'll ask Chantel to introduce the discussion, and I'd ask each panelist, and I'll do my best as well to speak clearly into the microphone.
So in the paper, the term embedded commission captured two components: trailing commissions and point-of-sale commissions paid by investment fund managers to dealers on purchases made under the deferred sales charge option, better known as the DSC, including the various low-load options that exist today. We heard through the comment process that when determining whether to discontinue embedded commissions and when assessing the potential impacts and outcomes of such a change, we should give separate consideration to each of the embedded commission components. Some argue that the DSC option should be maintained for reason that it plays a valuable role in facilitating access to advice, particularly for mass market investors, and in helping new advisors grow their business. So for the purpose of this discussion, we'll focus on the DSC option, separate and apart from any changes to trailing commissions. We want to better understand the role that the DSC plays today, independent of trailing commissions, and what the effects on competition in the industry, as well as access to advice, may be if the use of this purchase option is discontinued. The paper set out various concerns with mutual fund sales made under the DSC. Similar to the concerns raised by trailing commissions, the CSA is concerned about the conflict of interest that the DSC option can create. For example, representatives can be incentivized to promote the DSC option as it pays higher upfront commissions and higher total compensation over the life of the investment relative to other purchase options that may better suit the investor's needs, objectives, and time horizons. Research has also shown that the DSC option impacts investor behavior as it can make investors less sensitive to poor performance. It can keep them invested at a time when this may no longer suit their needs. Recent compliance reviews have revealed problematic practices from the use of the DSC option. For example, reviews conducted by the MFDA indicate that clients have been sold funds with redemption schedules that are longer than their investment time horizon. We've also seen evidence in MFDA enforcement files that the DSC option can incent dealers and their representatives to promote unsuitable leverage strategies or churn their clients' accounts. These practices lead to poor investor outcomes and must be addressed. We understand that the original rationale for the DSC option was to allow investors to invest without incurring any upfront costs, allowing an investor to put all of their money to work right away. This was an appealing option for investors who had long investment time horizons, especially given alternative options, which at the time of the advent of the DSC was commonly a front-end sales charge, often as high as 9%. Today's landscape, however, appears to be quite different. Presently, many industry stakeholders explain that commissions charged for purchases under the front-end option are negligible, if anything at all. This, together with the concerns we've identified in connection with the DSC, raises questions as to the benefits to investors of retaining the DSC option. And with that, I'll turn it back to Grant to ask questions and moderate the discussion.
Okay, thank you, Chantel. So and now we'll turn it over to our panelists. The first area that we wanted to explore is the basic rationale for DSCs and the benefit to investors. Given the evolution of the commission paid under the front-end sales charge option, which Chantel indicated originally was as much as 9%, we want to better understand the current rationale for the use of the DSC option. It's clear that sales made under this purchase option are beneficial for a dealer and representative, as it allows the dealer to collect typically as much as 5% of the amount invested directly from the investment fund manager. This option also benefits the investment fund manager, as the eventual redemption fee, if it's incurred, payable by an investor on the redemption made within a certain number of years from purchase, typically 5 to 7 years, is designed to deter an investor from redeeming the investment and accordingly helps the investment fund manager preserve assets under management. It's unclear, however, how this option benefits the investor when an investor can commonly purchase under a front-end commission option and pay negligible commissions. So the question really, and we'll start with Sunny Goldstein, is please explain why a dealer representative would offer a deferred sales option to an investor today, how it's beneficial for them, how it benefits the investor in these circumstances.
Thank you. Because I do sit on the board of the MFDA, I have to preface my remarks by saying that the opinions expressed today are mine and only mine and not any of the MFDA or other boards or people that I may represent. I also want to preface my remarks by saying that there is a lot of concern for the investor without giving any credit to the investor that these are adult grown people who are intelligent for the most part and do understand the entire concept of saving money, getting financial advice and paying for financial advice. So defending DSC fees is, and again, it's not a one size fits all. And there are places like leveraged accounts and like short-term horizons that they are not suitable, and I've never used them. But I have been involved in the mutual fund business since I was 18 years old when I bought my first mutual fund myself, and I've been selling them for more than 30 years, and I have never had a single complaint about DSC fees, which we use regularly for the benefit of not just me or my dealer, well, I am my own dealer, should make that clear. And I don't do it for the benefit of the fund companies to retain clients, because it doesn't matter which fund company we use. But when it comes to the investor, the knee-jerk reaction during a market downturn of pulling out a large investment I can go back to 2008-09. The markets dropped 50%. Index investors lost or would have lost 50% if they jumped out of the market. And many of them did jump out of the market because they had no access to advice. And in my dealer, in my case, the clients only went down 25%. And only one out of 1,500 clients actually took money out. They would not listen. But the other 1,499 did listen, and the fee, the DSC fee, is a deterrent. When I tell them, look, you're not just what you're down, it's also another 3%, 4%, 5% of DSC fees. Do you really want to pay that? Add insult to injury. Yeah, I mean, you don't need to. Just wait. Just wait it out. We've been through this before. And by giving that advice, and by 2010, every one of those clients was whole again. And that is the reason why, one of the reasons why we have DSC fees. And as far as, investor protection, looking after vulnerable seniors, a man and wife, 65 years old today, research shows and has been proven, one will live to age 91. That's a 26-year time horizon. And it's, paying a DSC fee or a commission or a trailing fee is not the worst thing to happen to a vulnerable investor. It's running out of money. And I've had people come to me that buy cat food when they don't own a cat because they don't have enough income, because they didn't plan, nobody planned for them and they didn't plan properly. So when we talk about the advice gap, it's very real that people need competent advice. And we talk about paying for that advice. No one questions how much of their taxes goes to OHIP or to pay their doctor. And when we talk, I mean, you can, I'm not an orthopedic surgeon, but an orthopedic surgeon does what? He listens to a patient, he gathers information, he analyzes the situation, and doesn't get paid, or gets paid a nominal $100 or a couple $100 for that. But when he presents the solution that it requires a scalpel, and there's a 3-month waiting list for a hip replacement or a knee replacement, but that's when he gets the $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000 to do the surgery. He gets paid for providing the solution to his advice. And advisors should not be treated any differently. And I've disclosed fees, DSC fees for the last 30 years and have never had a client say, oh no, that's not how you should be paid. And as far as the front end option goes, would it be fair for me to do 15, 20, 30 hours of work on a case and with a 1% trailing commission on a front load and 3 months later the client decides, oh, the person in the bank or the guy down the street or my nephew went into the business and they take all of that, my work, to someone else and I get a 0.25%? So let's level the playing field for everybody. Let's level it and make sure that the consumer is not hurt by DSC fees if properly applied. And nobody has talked about the 10% free unit redemption. Because the people don't want to lump all their money all at once, ever. I've been in this business 51 years and have never encountered that. What they want is an income. And even using a DSC fee will provide that income up to 10% of their asset every year for as long as they live, if they get good advice.
Okay, let's open it up to the other panelists. Would someone like to put the counterpoint on that?
Certainly. Marian Passmore from Fair Canada. Thank you for having me on the panel. I think in today's environment, there's no place for deferred sales charges any longer. I don't see any advantage to investors through having this so-called option. In fact, many people who are placed in DSC charges are not given any other alternative because of the incentives at play. They're put in those funds because the advisor gets the immediate commission up front. And so that's why we have 20% of mutual fund assets in Canada and DSCs as opposed to less than 1% in the U.S. and Europe. So with respect to other problems with DSCs, using DSCs and leverage, the last financial crisis and major market correction in 2008, we saw many people never recover from the use of leverage at that time. And so I don't think people in 2010 were back to where they were. Far from it. They had lost very often their homes or, significant savings that they otherwise had. So from our perspective, we see no independent evidence presented by any of the submissions that DSCs have a place in today's market.
Well, thank you. And, I'd emphasize that in this question, we're not talking about discontinuing trailing commissions overall. It's just the DSC option. So to the extent that there are other ways for paying for advice, they wouldn't be precluded by a discontinuance of a DSC option.
Yes, it's Barry McInerney, Mackenzie Investments. So I represent a panel, an independent asset management firm, so we don't support, advocate any particular model. We're obviously, what we do advocate for is choice. A choice for Canadians to choose their products, choice for Canadians to choose their financial advice, the provider, and choose how they want to pay for that advice. So I might add that DSC has proven there are good amounts of long-term investors using DSC, particularly those in the RDSP and RESP areas, and they have provided some that particular model for those particular investors has worked for them as other models work for other investors. And also, it does obviously over time and going forward, it has encouraged a discipline of savings for and long-termism for investors in a DSC model. And our discussions, obviously, as being an independent asset management firm, about 70% of our retail assets are distributed via the independent MFD dealers. Our dialogue with them has been over the years that there has been the vast majority of assets have not been subject to deferred charges before this DSC period has expired.
Okay, thank you. Let's move on.
Could I just quickly?
Yeah, very.
Sorry, John Adams. I run a large MFDA dealer. We sell a lot on a deferred sales charge basis. We're a little bit of a hybrid in that we have our own product, and we also have an open shelf. And there is no incentive one way or another for our advisors to sell our funds or third-party funds. Just in terms, we heard from Scott in the first panel with the amount of work that goes into a relationship up front. And this discussion, I believe, is about choice for investors having access to personal advice. When you get into particular into a small account, there has to be some compensation up front in order for that work to be done at the beginning of the relationship. The DSC option allows for that to be done with some compensation to the advisor. It works for the investor in that the fees are the same or relatively the same, assuming the funds stay there and the charge isn't incurred. But they get access to that advice, and we believe that has a value. So I think that's really where we're coming from, and particularly on the smaller accounts.
Okay, thank you.
And I just want to add one thing Barry said about our ESPs, for example. I have a fourth-generation client, the great-grandson of an original client, and her mother came in to buy an RESP for $200 a month. Does anybody think it would be fair to any advisor, forget me for the moment, but on a $2,500 annual sale to make $25 for the work that goes in, just the paperwork, let alone sending out four statements a year, let alone all the other costs associated. So unless you do that on a DSC basis, you can't do it. And the client doesn't get the product. Or they go to the bank or they go to the scholarship foundation where they get locked in forever. The alternatives are worse.
Okay, that's a good segue into the next question, which is really the advice gap and cost of advice. So the question is really an analysis of the anticipated impact, if any, on the elimination of the DSC option and overall access to and cost of advice for investors in the mass market segment. Could, in responding to this, could you clearly explain why the elimination may have those stated anticipated impacts? And I think we need to take into account that there are other ways for paying for advice. The lead on this one will be Marion.
Okay, so my understanding is that you would like me to respond to how access to advice and the cost of that advice would change if we simply eliminated deferred DSCs alone. And just to preface, before I answer that question, I just want to briefly state that I think today, just to have the wider context in mind, we have a significant advice gap in Canada right now. The simple fact is that Canadians often do not get objective professional advice in their best interest today. What we need is advice that is of high quality, proficient, and that isn't subject to financial incentives. So if we define advice as a group of investors who can obtain the amount of advice they desire at the price they're willing to pay, similar to what Neil was saying on the former panel, Canadians now don't get the kind of advice they want because what they want is advice, objective advice in their best interest, and they're not getting that. They're getting a very limited choice of what to be placed in based on what the advisor can sell and what his business model is like, his or her business model is like. So, and very often, investors are not aware of the fees and charges that they have when they get into a DSC fund, because despite the rules, many advisors do not disclose these fees up front. So if we do just look at how access to advice would be impacted if DSCs were eliminated, with the elimination of DSCs, investors would be placed in mutual funds in the other loads, in the other types of either no load or front load. Again, they'd be offered or recommended mutual funds rather than being necessarily given a choice of being placed in a different type of product, such as an ETF. These are the financial, why? Because the financial incentives would, encourage the advisor to recommend the mutual fund over a different product that might perform better or have, and or have lower costs. So I don't realistically foresee any material impact on the ability of dealer firms and their advisors to sustain a business model where GSCs are eliminated. As they've ably done in the past, I think firms will innovate and adjust and be able to continue to, provide mutual fund recommendations and the skewed advice that they currently do. With respect to costs, I don't think it will deal with the high mutual fund fee costs that Canadians currently pay. Effective price competition will still not exist. Mass market investors will still continue to be sold mutual funds with embedded commissions and likely, actively managed high-fee funds. If you look in the U.S., about 20% of mutual fund assets are in passive mutual funds, index mutual funds. In Canada, it's 1.5%. Why is that? Is it because investors in Canada have completely different needs than the U.S. investors? I don't think so. I think it's because of the distribution models here in Canada. So I think we'll have mutual funds still being sold to mass market investors with opaque costs, and they'll continue to be completely befuddled about how all these commissions and costs and redemptions and switch fees and so on work. One small benefit of getting rid of DSC funds, DSC loads, would be that the upfront commission that's financed by the investment fund manager would no longer be passed on to all the investors who hold that mutual fund. And so the MER might be slightly lower for that fund because the fund is no longer financing those upfront commission costs. And another benefit would be we would get rid of the 7-year redemption fee schedule that people in DSCs are now subject to, so that if they want to sell a fund and buy another one because it's performing poorly, they won't be have that disincentive any longer because people are reluctant to sell a fund, even if it is performing poorly, because of the fees that they're going to have to pay. And similarly, advisors don't necessarily want their clients to sell a fund because they continue to get the trailer if they stay in it. So that would increase slightly competition because an investor, if they wanted to move dealers, would not have to pay redemption fees if they can't move the investment in kind to another dealer and have to sell the funds in order to move. Right now, if they want to sell their funds, they might be subject to a redemption fee. In the future, they would not.
Okay, thank you. Let's, with a particular focus, I think it's the point is interesting about the switching fees and being able to change your investment decisions in particular, but I'd open it up to the other panelists.
Well, there's a lot of blanket statements that are not really applicable. We can start with why American investors have passive funds, because they are paying, on average, 1.5% fee for service on top of whatever the fund manufacturer puts in. So they're really paying more than Canadian investors for the same investments, not less. The fact that 74,000 approved persons across Canada are selling mutual funds, and there are less than, I don't want to be quoted by the MFDA people that may be in the room, but I believe it's less than 500 complaints about DSC fees on an annual basis. So, out of 74,000, don't try and paint everybody with the same, tire them with the same brush, that they're selling DSC and the people are negatively impacted. And as far as switching between poorly performing funds, the fees are per fund company. And I'm sure Barry can also add to that, that, you know, the average fund company today has 100 funds. If one is performing poorly, they probably have 8 or 10 in the same category and 90 in other categories that can be moved to without any DSC fee being incurred. And in over 30 years, I have never yet had any single client pay a DSC fee, and yet 90% of my funds are sold that way. So you got to take into account what is the actual that is happening and not the isolated few examples that disgruntled investors, and there are disgruntled people everywhere who do complain and do, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, and we hear about them. We don't hear about the other 99.5% of satisfied investors who are happy with the advice that they get. And that peace of mind comes from the result, not the investment, not how much is paid up front, not how much is paid during the course of their lives. It's from the result. Do they get a decent rate of return to provide the income they need for the rest of their lives? And every one of my clients can answer that positively. I have a couple of institutional investors, one with when I showed them on the CRM2 statement, and I took it to them at the end in January and showed them that the CRM2 fee for me was close to $100,000. And they said, that's not as much as a journeyman makes. We don't care what you make. We didn't give you $13 million. We gave you $9 million. We keep track. And that $9 million, you've made us $4 million. We don't care how much you make. Just keep doing what you're doing. And that is what investors want. And that is what we are obliged to give investors, is choice. This is not 1984, the book, not the year. This is not Big Brother watching you and protecting you with taking away your freedom of choice. This is Canada. Well, I think this is a free country where people should be allowed to choose how they want to pay.
We're not going to get through the questions if we have long speeches, I have to say.
I would just respond by saying that Cummings' research shows that DSC funds over the long term have been insensitive.
Cummings' research is flawed and is not
subject to review. No, it's not. So DSC investors have not fared well over the long term.
You know, I think another point to be made is that there are no standards for the performance by the particular advisor. So you may be providing the best advice to your clients, and I don't question it, but I think you might be the first to admit that that isn't a uniform standard, and you probably excel in comparison to some advisors who do far less.
There are rogue advisors. There are bad people. I'm not defending them. All I'm saying is that the vast majority, the 70-some thousand people out there, are doing the right thing by their clients and the best thing for them. And that is why we don't get the client complaints. Who is complaining? The OSC, the CSA, FAIR. I mean, these are not the consumers themselves.
Well,
I said this to the OSC. Yeah. What you're trying to do is regulate the jockeys when it's the horses that need the training.
So let's open it up to the other panelists to see if they feel that the fact that there aren't complaints by the mass market investor in the space, given their level of financial literacy and the fact that they may have better purchase options that are less costly, is something that we should take into account, or should we view this as a structural matter?
Well, just a couple of comments on what Marion said. You know, it's interesting. I get everybody's reluctant to pay a DSC fee, but they're quite happily pay an upfront fee. And I think that's a real concern here, is that investors may be reluctant to pay up front as well, and so we could end up having less people invested. Our experience is similar to Sunny's. The vast majority are not paying in our firm. We've analyzed it, or they're paying under $100 in DSCs, so I think we need to analyze exactly what the exposure to fees are. And just a reminder that the DSC fee is financed to a significant extent by a reduced trailer fee, which comes out of the dealers' and advisors' compensation. In terms of, back to the question, the access to advice, Our advisors go out to individuals' homes. They look at their entire situation. Yes, they recommend our products, but we've got a wide shelf to choose from. They sit down with them on a personal basis going through their situation. And really, for the small accounts, the DSC option enables them to do that. And in the next question, I'll cover that, why that's the case.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the next question. It's the impact to dealer business models and representative succession planning. Please explain the anticipated impact, if any, of a discontinuation of the DSC option on dealer business models, as well as how the impacts may differ between integrated and independent dealer models. For example, will dealers need to compensate their representatives differently than they do today? Will they need to offer their clients alternative forms of payment options than they do today? In responding to this question, please comment on whether these changes may impact the recruitment of new advisors and the ongoing retention of advisors as a reason often cited by industry stakeholders in support of maintaining the DSC option is that the DSC allows newer, smaller advisors to enter the profession and build their book of business with some certainty about their compensation, a practice that may perpetuate a culture of salespersons, we would argue, rather than investment professionals. Why should investors bear the expenses associated with recruitment and retention?
I have the lead on this, so I have a few prepared comments. Thank you for the opportunity to present today. The majority of our firm's accounts are under $100,000, and our median account size is below $12,000. Economies of scale, account structure, and significant investments in technology enable us to maintain a reasonable cost per account. The DSC model works well for investors and advisors. To receive personal advice and products they need, investors do not have to pay a significant upfront percentage of the amount they have available to invest. They are charged the same or about the same fees, and all of their money is put to work immediately. Advisors receive some upfront compensation for the significant initial effort on new contributions. If the DSC structure is banned, dealers and advisors that service smaller accounts and offer a broad shelf of products may not be able to generate enough initial revenue to properly compensate them for their upfront work. This may result in fewer accounts, impacting a dealer's ability to maintain the scale to cost-effectively service those that remain. The economics are straightforward. $10,000 invested in an equity fund on a DSC basis generates $500 in upfront commission. This is split between the dealer, the advisor, and the advisor's supervisors. The trailer fee in the DSC period is cut in half to help compensate for this. The same fund sold on a 0% front-end basis will generate a 1% ongoing trailer fee, which is $100 per year or $8.33 per month, again split between the dealer, the advisor, and the supervisors. The compensation flow no longer follows the work effort. In many models, including ours, advisors must pay their expenses out of this revenue. Options include an upfront fee or commission, but this disadvantages a smaller investor in particular as it reduces the amount available to invest. It may also act as a deterrent to them investing at all. Dealers could provide the upfront compensation, but there's two issues with this. Many dealers would not have the capital to do so, and there would likely need to be some kind of recovery method similar to a deferred sales charge should the investor leave the dealer after a short period of time. Developing new advisors and servicing smaller accounts is complementary. In order to gain experience and build the foundation of a book of business, a new advisor under the supervision of someone more experienced is more likely than an established advisor to put the effort in on a smaller account. Still, the advisor needs to be compensated for their efforts, and the DSC model provides this while also benefiting investors. Servicing small accounts is not the only thing at stake. A structure to generate reasonable compensation attracts new advisors, which renews a rapidly aging advisory force. Investors benefit from this as it helps them maintain a financially sound dealer network, and new advisors offsetting natural attrition provide service continuity. As to the cost question, at our firm and many others, advisors are independent contractors. While there are costs, prospective advisors are not compensated for their time and effort for training and to get licensed. It's not a significant cost borne by the investors, as the question would suggest. Yeah, thank you.
Other, yes?
If I could just reinforce a couple of John's comments. Our view, again, is financial advice is absolutely essential for Canadians to save for their retirement years. And financial advice has proven to be very creative in terms of disciplined saving, saving more often, saving more, tax-effective saving, estate planning. All that is very important for Canadians to get access to have choice. And any change to the model that might disrupt that access is going to be detrimental to the Canadians. One change to the model, unintended consequence, might be you have fewer advisors, because to John's point is that this might impact the succession planning of advisors in Canada. That's not good, because, again, that would limit the choice. Our understanding with the independent MFDA dealers that over 70% of the client assets that they oversee are with accounts less than $100,000. It's going to mostly impact the smaller Canadians, those Canadians that need the advice most, and those Canadians that would be most impacted if they weren't able to have choice and access to advice. So, that's our position. You know, I think the benefit of financial advice is undeniable. Choice is important. To have that accessible by all Canadians is important. And I might add, I'm going to get a little off topic here, just the active versus passive. I'll be 30 seconds on this one. Because I just came back. I worked in the United States for 15 years. I just came back to Canada last year. It's nice to be back, by the way, for a variety of reasons. And I oversaw companies, investment companies in U.S., Europe, Middle East, and Asia. So I had a vantage point of seeing regulations come in, some come in, some did not come in, and seeing how intended consequences occurred, which were some were positive and some unintended consequences occurred that were negative. And it's just a very, very delicate ecosystem. It's working right now. Choice is important. We have new models always evolving. Robo-advisors are coming in. You've got bundled choices, unbundled choices. Again, in Canada, obviously, we have a very powerful, vertically integrated, bank-owned, bank branch distribution model that is one of the largest and most concentrated in the world. And that's another model that works very well for some Canadians, but of course 95% of product delivered through that channel is proprietary. So again, if someone wants to have another choice, another model, then they can choose another model. So it's important to have the choice in the models and accessible to all Canadians.
And that really leads into the next question that was also one we were taking the lead on the effect of competition, and if we were to ban the DSC, how it would affect the competitive marketplace in Canada, how would it relate to the concentration that exists, or would it affect integrated versus smaller firms in different ways? And you do have the benefit of this comparative viewpoint, if you want to amplify on that.
Sure, I'll jump in. And, another, another observation I've had being back in Canada is the dialogue has been extremely thoughtful. And we're taking our time, all the stakeholders, with this decision. And we have to, because we all want to get it right. I mean, everyone in this room wants to get this decision right on behalf of Canadians. So, as we know, what happens when you have some regulation that are adopted, like CRM2, which makes disclosure, is absolutely table stakes. I mean, you have to have disclosure across the board. When you start to have just dialogue on other models, maybe shifting of models, what happens is at times you start to have good, positive discussions, and trends start to occur with the natural market forces towards where we might have a better balance, let's say, in Canada between bundled and unbundled paradigms. In the U.S., of course, as we know, it's the natural forces of nature take good and bad in U.S., and it's a free enterprise, and so markets just kind of move with natural forces. And so we're seeing this even at McKenzie. I'm sure other of the manufacturers are seeing this, where, for instance, the percentage of our gross sales in F-series and in the unbundled series, 10 years ago, in 2007, 5% of our gross sales were in F-series. Last year, 33% of our gross sales were in unbundled F-series, and this year will be over 40%. So it's just naturally occurring where we have, again, a gravitation to that, to the fee-based model where advisors are comfortable with that and Canadians are comfortable in choosing that model, but that's starting to become larger than the bundled model. But again, the bundled model, as we've all said, some of us have said, that's a very important choice as well for Canadians, because particularly the smaller Canadians with smaller account sizes, they need to access that advice. It's the only way they can access it. And again, the financial advice has been measured and proven to add, the gamma has been measured and proven to add significant value, arguably over what the independent managers can provide. It's the financial advice that actually is the cornerstone of the retirement security being met by Canadians across this country. So I'll stop there.
And open it up to other panelists.
Well, the benefits of advice, and I'll refer to research, qualified research by both Advocus and Ipsos that proved conclusively by financial outcome that Canadians getting advice have 3 to 4 times the amount saved for retirement than those not getting financial advice.
I think everyone agrees that advice is valuable. It's just how we're talking about compensating for it.
Well, then you know, I think it's Will Rogers that said, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Because it's not broke. I mean, this system has worked for the last, let's go back to 1937, an act of Parliament that established unit trusts and gave protection to investors. We'll go back to 1954 when Sir John Templeton created the Templeton Growth Fund and said, how can an ordinary person know how to invest? And he created a fund where there were, at that time, 1,700 in potential investments in the world. And he created a fund that if you had put your $10,000 into that fund back then, it would be worth $3.2 million today. So it works. It really does work. And $1.4 trillion of Canadian savings that have been accumulated because of the way we distribute the product. And now you want to change that distribution method by changing the way it's compensated. It's not broken. We have to take a step back and not try and fix something that the unintended consequence will be the $200 a month investor, and there are thousands of them, and John can attest, his average client size, $12,000. Not, you know, and Barry, when he says 40% in F-series funds, how many actual investors is that? 5%? 3%? The wealthy are buying F-class because they can pay for advice. But the ordinary person, the person that I am responsible to, will not, and in many cases cannot, pay for advice. And the detriment of making them pay up front, out of pocket, where that money could be invested for their retirement, and instead it's going to go to pay for the advice, it's wrong. It's fundamentally wrong.
I think the approaches that we're exploring is if there's a less expensive way, given that cost in recent years has been an enormous determinant of performance. The issue is, can we get these services that Canadians deserve to Canadians at a lower cost?
And we can. We can standardize or cap. I prefer the capping, but that's another discussion. And we can eliminate DSC where there is no advice for robo-investing, leveraging. There should be no DSC associated with leveraging. That's wrong. And we can agree on those things. But in terms of me being able to, and I don't have sub-advisors. I have two, but the family. The ability for a firm like John's to bring in a young person and grow in the business, as I did for 50 years. And this idea that commission salespeople, is something wrong with that? Most of the professional advisors out there started that way, and they paid for their own education, they paid for their own courses, they paid for professionalism. I have 10 letters behind my name because I wanted to be better at what I do for my clients, and I am, and so are most of the professionals out there. Let's not all keep attacking them for the way that they are paid.
Okay, others who wish to go on competition?
On the competition point, I think that if we solely remove DSCs but don't also remove embedded commissions, we won't have enough transformation to have a more competitive market for investors. And that's what we all want here in the room, is to have a vibrant, competitive market where objective advice is provided to Canadians at a reasonable cost so that they can have adequate savings for their retirement. And, you know, there's a number of factors why Canadians don't necessarily understand that the cost that they're paying and move to other models that are lower cost at the moment. I mean, we do have robo-advice now, which has the ability to provide investment advice at lower cost, and some small accounts, you know, and younger people and some older people are moving to robo-advice. And if we remove choices that are suboptimal and harm market efficiency and investor outcomes, we will transform our market and be able to move to a model where we have the ability to get rid of conflicted advice and compensation structures that don't serve investors' interests, and be able to move to a better models where advice in the best interest of the client can be provided.
Okay, thanks.
Could I just finish up the competition issue?
Sure.
We would like to continue to provide personal advice to that smaller investor, mm-hmm. and the DSC model does work for that. I am concerned if you pull it away. We're already seeing advisors and firms going upscale, dumping off small accounts to their robo-arm or whatever. We don't think that's in the best interest of the Canadian investing public, frankly, so we'd like to continue that. An integrated model, I'm not an expert on it, but I know there are economics there that you can cover off a lot of smaller accounts if you've got money coming in on the investment side. So I think it will reduce the number of firms, continue to reduce the number of firms that are willing to service that market, and I do believe it will reduce competition.
And I just want to add, there isn't a shred of evidence that competition has been affected by fee structure, not one shred that I have ever seen. There are dozens of fund companies. There are thousands of mutual funds. There are six chartered banks, six major banks. Are they not in competition with each other for that savings market? So competition is not being affected by how we're paid. And to come up with a blanket statement that by changing that, that's going to cure everything is fundamentally wrong.
No, I think we want to base our decisions on empirical analysis and input from stakeholders, so we're not making those sorts of conclusory statements. But let's move to the next item, the next question. And I think it may be an area of potential agreement given some of the discussion that's occurred, and that it relates to enhancements to DSC practices. Should the CSA decide to continue to allow the use of the DSC option, what enhancements could we make to current rules to limit misuse of the DSC and ensure that the use of the option is both beneficial and suitable for investors? For example, how can we ensure that clients will not be sold funds with DSC redemption schedules that are longer than their investment time horizon, and that any opportunity to engage in improper leverage strategies will be reduced? What other enhancements can be made to ensure that investors are fully aware of applicable redemption charges? So I'd really ask that you know, if you can, to make concrete suggestions about if we preserve DSC as part of the competitive environment that that you believe exists, how do we address these problematic practices? For us, it's not enough to say that enforcement and examinations does the trick. We're talking about structural changes to make sure that problematic practices like the ones we described and the MFDA has found are not routine. So I'd ask Barry to weigh in on this.
I'll be brief again so I can let my fellow panelists speak, and we have a lively Q&A thereafter. I just want to reiterate again that we believe the market forces are afoot that are addressing a lot of the concerns in light of the CRM2 and other regulations that have been passed to date. And we do believe the regulation should be proportionate to the issue. We're a little concerned that banning of DSCs and embedded commissions would be disproportionate, particularly to the independent dealer channels. But I will just cite one concrete idea. It would be in citing the MFDA DSC sweep report published in December 2015. And we'd encourage the regulators to work collaboratively with SROs such as the MFDA. And they brought forth ideas such as suitability of time horizon, client age, and disclosure of redemption charges. They also have established supervisory controls and procedures to oversee, and in some cases limit or restrict, trading in DSC funds. And Sonny knows this probably better than I do, as John, but I think the MFDA has reported back that they're making very good progress in light of those ideas. So again, you know, also considering outside of the sweep report, considering requiring asset levels for DSC sales. So enhanced supervision, looking at time horizon, age, maybe asset thresholds, and finally, stating the obvious again, more fulsome disclosure.
Okay, thank you.
On that point, I believe that, I mean, we already have it in the 14-page document that clients sign off on, but there should be a separate DSC schedule showing the 7-year DSC fee that the client signs separately, that it goes through the head office or the dealer, the head office of the dealer or the fund company, gets signed back and delivered to the client in a countersigned version, so there is no doubt that the client understands the DSC schedule that they've signed off on, and with a cooling off period. If they say no, that I didn't understand that, I don't want it, we can change it. So that would be one thing. No, and I've said before, not on early redemption, like where the low short time frame, and certainly not on leveraging. And I might add, tax-free savings accounts. We do not do any of them on a DSC basis because we want that money to be available. And yet I see countless examples of people buying 5-year non-redeemable GICs at 1.5% in their TFSA, and they don't understand. You talk about disclosure. When they want to take their money out, they can't get it. And it's a tax-free savings account. And they can't get their money because the non-redeemable aspect of a GIC was not explained to them at point of sale. So point of sale information is paramount, and a separate disclosure form would be go a long way to making sure that people who buy DSC know what they've bought. But give them the choice. Give them the choice to buy it.
Thank you. Others?
Yeah. Having said what I said, DSC isn't perfect, and it can be improved. I have a number of things, but a couple of more significant ones, one that we've implemented for a long time at our firm, and the second one that I'm not sure will work. But at our firm, we have a one-commission policy. So as new money comes into the dealer, you're allowed to go into a DSC schedule. If you switch between fund companies within our firm, because we have a broad shelf, that goes in at 0% front end, so that there is not a renewal of the DSC schedule in perpetuity. Once they're out, and that's it. We implemented it because of a churning issue, which Marion mentioned at the beginning, and I believe it's worked well for us and for our clients. The one that I'm not sure will work, and I've got my operations chief there probably sending me daggers, but capping account sizes at the dealer as to when you can use DSC. There's operational issues around that, but I think it serves the smaller investor. Let's focus on them and leave the larger ones, you know, at 0% front end. Quickly, other things, there are already restrictions on sales to seniors we put in place. DSC schedule can't be longer than the time horizon. A review of large DSC charges going out to make sure that they're appropriate. The disclosure, as Sunny mentioned, and leverage, we made the decision at our firm because of the market wind not to leverage, but there are significant MFDA restrictions on leveraging. So I believe we could make it work much better.
Okay. You know, I was also curious about the practices about withdrawals for emergency fund use without penalty. Is that, I'm just curious, is that uniform across the market where if you suddenly have a sick relative and have an unforeseen expense that you can take out a certain amount? Or is that something that's susceptible to regulatory intervention to make sure that Canadians have access to funds without a penalty on the schedule if they really need it?
I'm not sure it's a standard practice, but it's one that could be considered. We look at every complaint case individually and try to be fair. I'll say that.
I've only had a handful of those situations, and in every case I've offered to compensate for the DSC fee, and in every case, the clients refused because how much they had made in the interim was way more than the DSC fees, and they didn't want to take money out of my pocket because they had a problem. But I agree that it should be available the same as you know, living benefits and insurance. If somebody's got a problem, you give them their money back, and I would not have any issue with that being legislated, under certain conditions.
Great. So thank you to our panelists. We have a little time for questions. If you have cards, our people will come around and bring them up. And I know John has a few already, so we'll try and deal with as many questions as we can.
Sure. So the first question I have goes to some research that IFIC, I believe, carried out that says that the primary benefit of advice is actually in encouraging good investing behavior rather than in asset allocation choices. Do we really need to have a DSC to support good investing behavior, or are there other ways of solving the economic problem that advisors and dealers have?
In my experience, it helps, but you have to convince the client at the outset that the only way to long-term success is to save part of everything you make and keep it saved. And you drum that home, and I've drummed it home from the teenagers all the way to 75-year-olds. You got to understand, we protect the principal, keep it saved. And as long as they do that, and I have 550 people drawing an income, and they take what they make, and they don't impact the principal, and they're very happy. And it's education. It's client education.
Yeah, and it's not good investor behavior. Well, go out there, save some money, and off you go, and it's done in half an hour. Usually involves a couple of meetings. If you're in a rural area, distance involved, travel cost. It takes a while to build up that relationship and that understanding in order to put that behavior in place.
I don't think you, given that a lot of Canadians have their investments in RRSPs, I don't think you need the additional savings discipline of a redemption penalty in order to incent savings, because you already get penalized if you take money out of your RRSP. So I don't see that as an added benefit for an investor, quite the contrary, nor is it sort of disclosed up front that that's what they're signing up for when they are sold a DSC.
Well, I administer over $350 million of group RSP assets, and the unions that have given access to that money, the redemption rate is as high as 30%. So people will cash in their RSPs, pay the tax, and go and buy the toy that they want to buy, and they end up old and broke. And I've seen it. So again, people, the RSP aspect is no deterrent to somebody who really wants to go and buy a new motorcycle.
And the issue is where the money will come from to do that, getting out of high cost debt and getting that program in place, not the fact that it's in there or the DSC is keeping it there. It's getting set up in the first place.
We have a number that are along the same idea, which is, won't technology help solve this problem? Won't it drive down costs and allow mass customization far more economically than it is today? I guess that's not really a question, it's more a statement, but if anyone would like to reflect off that.
I might answer from a little different perspective because you mentioned technology. So obviously RoboAdvisor is a huge use of technology. From our perspective, it's another model, which is great. We have new models coming into Canada, and it's another model that Canadians can access. And in fact, it's bringing in millennials into the ecosystem, the retirement ecosystem, earlier than they normally come in. And that's a good thing because they're starting to save early. And if it takes the technology inducement and the low or no human touch and the social responsible type investment options to lure them in, let's bring them in. But again, once they're in and they commence their retirement journey, then we'll see how their needs might change and their advice needs might change. So I just want an angle on technology. I know yours was more on the, obviously, using technology to be more efficient and scalable, and that's clearly the case for any asset management company, which we're focused on. But I just want to touch on RoboAdvisor since you mentioned technology.
And certainly for any dealer, including us, it's imperative that we invest in that, and we do have a significant investment. Getting rid of the paper and making it more efficient so that a proper job can be done.
I can only concur.
many studies show that the best predictor of future outperformance are lower fees today. Past performance is definitely not a good predictor. In a DSC model, people have to sell a higher cost version of the product because that is embedded in. Don't the two get in the way of actually better performance over the longer term?
Yes and no. With the choices out there, the thousands, literally thousands of mutual funds available, again, through experience and research and whatever, we found that the top performing funds over long periods of time continue to outperform. And they outperform the indexes, certainly. They outperform their peers over long periods of time. And we focus on those funds. It has nothing to do with the compensation. It has to do with the best outcome for the clients. And I'm proud of our long-term history of outperforming everything else in sight. And that's what clients want. They want the result. They don't care about the fee. They care about the result. And as long as we can deliver that over, in my case, 51 years, so I got to say something.
If I could add, because it does lend itself to this, again, active versus passive discussion, because there has been a lot of chatter I've noticed last year or so, again, being back in Canada, of almost implying low cost is better for the Canadian investor. And I think Mary made a good point. I think it's important to separate out the issues. One issue is the availability of low cost options. And then the other issue is what's better, active versus passive. So on the latter issue, nothing's better. I've been at this 30 years. I mean, you use both, right? We're an agnostic manufacturing solutions, asset management firm, whatever you want to call us. We use both. I mean, you can use them both in a portfolio for the benefit of the investor. So, it's good to separate out the active versus passive, that one's not better than the other, to low costs. Now, certainly what we're seeing going forward is, yes, you see this more in the institutional world, it's coming to the retail world in Canada, where there was a predominant focus on alpha and returns and irrespective costs, and there's becoming a more focused on balancing, producing those returns in a more efficient manner, and efficiency usually means lower costs. So we predict that in Canada's a little behind in terms of passive options, arguably ETF is not necessarily only passive. There's a lot of active and smart beta ETFs, but ETFs are going very fast in Canada. They lag the speed and depth of the U.S. marketplace, but they will catch up. And so, therefore, just naturally, competitive forces will provide more options for Canadians and us manufacturers to put a wider variety of investment vehicles and strategies and types together on behalf of the client's portfolio.
Yes, my hope would be that models and the environment evolves so that clients have greater control over those costs themselves, because costs are a huge predictor of overall returns. And if you're in a 2% mutual fund over 50 years, two-thirds of your amount is going to get eaten up in costs. And most investors have no idea that's the case.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thanks to our panelists today. I guess someone, one point of view has to be the final one, but we've had and it is true that costs are really critical. So is performance, and so is choice. So I think we've had a vigorous debate, and we'll continue it in the third panel. Now we'll take a 20-minute break.